I experience this both as a teacher and as a parent, you know, and I see it a lot amongst teachers. You know, I'm on a lot of teacher Facebook groups and everything. And I so often see, you know, I have this student with really difficult behaviors and, you know, the advice is, well, just, you know, cut them loose or whatever. And I'm just, oh no, don't, you know, because to me, really, when a student is exhibiting challenging behavior, it's really a sign that they're in distress.
Hi there, teachers. It's Tim here again, and welcome back to another episode of The Topcast. You're listening to episode number 230. Very special welcome to all the top music teachers out there. You're in for an absolute fantastic show today, particularly if you teach students who are a little bit unusual, a little bit different, those with what we call exceptionalities. And I love this word, and we're talking about it in today's episode. So we're going to be discussing how the Lotus Centre in Canada brings music teaching to special needs students and students with all abilities, in fact. And we know that all our students are individual and need a tailored approach, and never is this more true than our students with exceptionalities. Now, we have a fantastic freebie for today. It's Dr. Parks, my guest's 5 tips for teaching students with exceptionalities. And it's a great one-page little cheat sheet that you can have in your folder or on your desk so that you can refer to it whenever you have a student come into your studio who might need some extra attention and a slightly different approach. It's going to remind you about some of those key factors that we talk about in today's episode. So if you'd like to grab that freebie, just head to topmusic.co/episode230. My guest today received her Bachelor of Music, Master of Arts in Musicology, and Graduate Certificate in Piano Pedagogy Research from the University of Ottawa. She holds a PhD in music education from McGill University, where she researched how to effectively train studio music teachers to work with students with autism. In 2012, my guest founded the Lotus Centre for Special Music Education. It's a charitable organisation committed to providing access to music education for people with exceptionalities, and she currently serves there as the executive director. Recently, she launched the Lotus Centre Institute for Professional Development in order to provide music teachers with the skills and tools they need to help students with exceptionalities reach their full potential. In addition to her role at Lotus Centre, my guest today is an adjunct professor at the University of Ottawa, teaching courses and guiding students in special music education. Welcome to the show, Dr. Erin Parks. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I so enjoyed exploring your website recently and finding out more about all the amazing things that you're doing and have done over the past. So tell us a little bit about the Lotus Centre in particular and how that came to be.
Mm-hmm. So the Lotus Centre is a charitable organization based in Ottawa, Canada. And our work is really centered around providing access to music education for people with exceptionalities. And so we do this through a lot of different activities. The core, you know, thing that we offer is music education for people with exceptionalities. So we have, you know, private music lessons and a whole bunch of instruments. We have a choir, we have an after-school program, we have music camps, all of that. But we also partner with arts organizations in the city, orchestras, that kind of thing, to help them develop adaptive programming. We also do research. I'm also a professor at the University of Ottawa, so we do a lot of research into best practices in this area, special music education. And we also do professional development. I see that as a really key part of, you know, building access is training more teachers to be able to, you know, help these students reach their full potential.
And we're looking forward to finding out a little bit more about what you offer teachers later on. We've had on Top Music, I've had a number of interviews with other specialists in this area. We've had a course created inside our academy on this topic. So it's one that's very close to my heart. I have had some experience teaching students. I can remember one in particular with autism, but I haven't got vast experience in this area. So it's wonderful to speak to someone who not only has practical experience, but you've done the research too, which is incredible. So I'm looking forward to finding out more about that from you today. But one of the things that I did notice, and you used it just in your first few sentences, you used this word exceptionalities rather than something like special needs. So I'm really keen to know, that's obviously a conscious decision. So can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, and actually, you know, if you look at, you know, our website or some of our literature, we did use the term special needs, but it's just one of those things that, you know, in the community, different terms kind of come in and out of social acceptance, I guess. And it varies a lot around the world. Different countries use different terms. And in Canada in particular, the term special needs is starting to fall out of favor a little bit amongst some, you know, disability activist groups. And so, you know, a lot of people are kind of reclaiming the term disabilities. But for me, I'm also a special needs parent. So I have two of my three kids have exceptionalities.
Right.
And so for me, you know, I'm actually not too particular about it myself, but I am very conscious of being in that community of, you know, parents and what their preferences are and just being sensitive to that. Mm. And exceptionalities is a term that everybody seems to accept and feel good about. And it sort of catches all of it because really, you know, all that exceptionalities denotes is that there's something different from what's typical.
The norm, you're the exception kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's no sort of negative connotation with that. It's just something different from the norm. And so that's sort of the term that we're using now and is kind of leaning towards being the preferred term, at least where we are working.
Mm. Yeah, I like it too. And I understand that. And language has changed over time because I've had discussions with other people about the use of the spectrum and ASD. So autism spectrum disorder, are kids on the spectrum? Is that okay to use? Is it not? And these things, as you say, they change geographically, but they also change over time. Is there any other obvious one that you can just quickly suggest to teachers that they might rethink their use of? Is there anything else that is like, oh, we don't use that anymore?
No, well, you know what? It is really, there's no one, and again, it is very geographic. In Canada, you know, generally speaking, we don't use the word disability. But in the United States, they use it very widely. That's sort of the term that they use. So, you know, it's hard to say, don't use this because it depends on where you are. I would just say, try to maybe do some research in the community where you're working and be sensitive to what's happening there, because, you know, a lot of parents or the students themselves have had some challenging interactions with some of the terms, right? And so it's just really about being sensitive to how they feel, whether you have a preferred term or not, just being sensitive to how the community feels about different terms. But from my perspective, you know, there's not really a lot that's really off limits. I know spectrum, even, you know, spectrum for me is one thing because I do have a son who's on the autism spectrum, but I also have a daughter who's on the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And so there's more than one spectrum. And I've seen a few people say that like the spectrum is kind of owned by autism now.
All right.
But there are a lot of spectrum disorders actually. And it kind of, you know, so just being sensitive again to there's a lot out there and people have different feelings.
I guess it comes back to treating each child individually and each parent and that relationship that you have as an individual interaction and finding out from the parents what they would like, what words they would like to use and what the child is comfortable with and things like that. So
exactly.
It comes back to the roots of what we do with all our students, I guess, in our studios. I'm really keen, Erin, to dig into your own musical education before we find out a little bit more about what you're doing today. Can you tell us what kind of, so you're a pianist, I believe?
Yes.
What kind of lessons did you have and when did you start?
Very traditional. I started very young. I was three because my mom was a
three.
Piano teacher as well. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I cannot imagine teaching a three-year-old.
You know, well, actually, I do teach a lot of three-year-olds now, but I think I was quite a precocious child, though. But yeah, I started at three, but it was very traditional. I did, you know, classical music. You know, I studied classical music in university. I learned, you know, mostly by note reading. I didn't do a lot of, you know, any kind of popular genres. I didn't do a lot of improv. I didn't do any of that. It was really quite traditional. And so, you know, one of the things that I've found in my teaching is learning other ways of being in music education, because for me, that was the way, you know, for most of my life.
Mm. Did you study through high school and then into university? Study music,
yes.
That is? Yeah. So you have a degree in music originally, like straight out of school, you went and continued your studies?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Piano performance was where I started out.
Okay. And did you go straight into teaching quite early as well?
I did. I started teaching when I was 16.
Right.
Yeah. And I loved it. Like I, you know, when I was in high school, I thought I was going to become a lawyer actually, but then I started teaching when I was 16 and I fell in love with teaching. And then in particular, when I was in university, I worked on one project working with Northern Indigenous people in Canada. We taught them through video conference. This was in the early 2000s. So like, whoa. Now it's not a big deal to teach through video conference, but in 2003 it was. And, you know, that project and having that impact through teaching, you know, was like, wow, this is, you know, really worthwhile. So I've been teaching ever since I was 16.
There you go. And so how did the teaching of special needs or students with exceptionalities, how did that become an interest for you? Was it through your own children or your teaching experience?
Well, it was both. I did, when I was, you know, teaching, even before I had children, when I was in university, I had several students with different diagnoses and I did well with them. I didn't have any training at all. I didn't really necessarily know what I was doing, but I enjoyed working with them. And, you know, I found they did well with me. And so at the studio where I was working, I started being kind of the teacher that worked with students with exceptionalities. And there was one in particular that was very close to my heart that had autism. And actually, he started with me when he was 3. He was quite young.
Oh, wow.
And he stayed with me until he went to university. And he was really
amazing.
You know,
oh my goodness.
My first student with autism, and it really, you know, changed, you know, the course of my life. But at the same time, it wasn't on my radar that this was a thing you could specialize in. You know, it was just, I was a piano teacher and I liked working with these students and that's what I did. It was really when I went to start working on my PhD in 2010. And my son, at the same time that I was applying to do my doctoral work, my son was diagnosed with autism. And so as a parent, you know, I just started researching autism all the time because that's what you do as a parent when your child is diagnosed. I found that trying to find, you know, music teachers or martial arts teachers or anybody was really challenging just to find services for him. And I kind of, you know, slowly started to put together, you know, maybe other parents are feeling this way about finding services for their kids. And well, I could offer music services for these kids. And I'm learning a lot through, you know, my son and researching autism. And it was also just practically, I was spending so much time researching autism that I was like, well, if I can turn this into my doctoral research too, that would kind of
make a lot of sense.
One stone.
Right.
So that's kind of where that started. And I saw a real hole. Like, you know, this was, you know, 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago. A lot has been done since then. You know, I'm so happy to see the growth in this area, but there really wasn't a lot out there. But at the same time, as I was researching, I was seeing, you know, the incredible abilities that people with autism in particular can have in music, and how much potential there is, you know, to offer them something that can really be a really special outlet for them. And so it just, my, you know, personal and professional lives kind of merged into this.
What was the doctoral research? What did you end up settling on? What was your thesis?
It was training teachers to work with students with autism. So I put together a training program and then I researched the impact of that.
Wonderful. There you go. And that's now grown into your institute, I imagine, much of that research. You're fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah. I was just thinking as you were speaking there, one of the things I've certainly learned about teaching students with exceptionalities is that you have to be incredibly flexible. And it sounds like you had an incredibly rigid classical training, which of course many of us do. So I wonder, how did you bridge that gap? Because that is a challenge for a lot of teachers who have been brought up in that very traditional, you read and perform and interpret music realm, and then realizing that really the way to make an impact, well, with all students, let's face it, is to be flexible and have multiple approaches. How did you learn about those or get those skills?
Very gradually. It was a long process because I think I am also a very structured person just myself by nature. So that sort of traditional approach made sense to me and worked for me. So I never, as a student, needed to seek out these other, you know, approaches to learning. I was really fortunate as a young teacher to start training to teach the Yamaha method, which is like an ear-based creativity method. And that really opened my eyes a lot to different approaches. And I use elements of that actually a lot in my work with students with exceptionalities. But I also, you know, in university, I did study piano pedagogy and music education. So I learned about, you know, Dalcroze and all these different sorts of approaches. So it was really through, you know, it was through sort of formal training on, you know, more informal sorts of approaches that I learned. And then just in learning those approaches kind of thought, oh, well, I could apply this to this and pull this from this. And, you know, the more you have in your toolkit, the more you kind of learn to pick and choose what you need for each student.
Mm. So you've gone and done your research, you've started teaching students, and you've become a little bit known for that in the school that you were teaching at. You eventually then must have broken out onto your own and established your own space, which became the Lotus Center. So can you tell us, was it just you to begin with, and how did that start?
Yeah, it was just me. And I really didn't know if anybody would come, really. And it really was just, like I said, with my own son, I thought, you know, I'm seeing that there's not a lot out there. I'm starting to be connected to other autism parents in the community and, you know, kind of just felt out a little bit, hey, would you come to a music school for kids with, you know, autism or exceptionalities? And at least a few people said they would. So I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And, you know, yeah, really didn't know where to go, but it grew, you know, much more than I thought. Like, we're starting our 10th year now. And, you know, we have about 150 students that come every week pre-COVID. Right now we're on a little bit of a hiatus, but, you know, every week for music lessons, and we reach about 500 students, you know, a year, and we have, you know, 10 teachers, and, you know, it's grown so much, and it just really shows the need. But really it was just, I thought maybe this would be a gap I could fill. And so I went for it.
Mm, congratulations on the growth. It's quite amazing. And is there a significance in the word lotus? Kind of reminds me of lotus flowers and oriental or Asian kind of things. Is that intentional?
Yes. Yeah. It symbolizes growing into your full potential. And for me, that's really what our approach is all about, is, you know, it's helping each student reach whatever their full potential is, and the recognition that that's totally different for everybody. That's true for all students, but especially for students with exceptionalities. And it's really about bringing them to where they can go.
Mm. And so what's your main role there? What day to day, do you get much time to teach, or are you mainly administering?
I make time to teach. I mean, really, you know, at heart, I'm a teacher. So I definitely could fill my day full time with administration, but that's not my favorite part of the job. So I do, you know, still teach several days a week. I try to be honest, delegate as much of the administrative stuff as I can, because that's for me, you know, I do it so that Lotus Center can exist, but it's not, you know, it's not
your strength,
what I'm all about.
Mm.
And so I'm focusing more and more now on, you know, growing the research side and the professional development side, now that our programs are pretty well developed, and certainly, you know, still teaching myself.
Mm. And do you teach any adults, or is it all children?
We do. It's mostly children. I mean, it's probably 90% children, but we have students of all ages.
You talk about empathy-based approaches. I want to sort of talk a little bit, shift to more about the pedagogy and some tips for our listeners too. You talk about this, an empathy-based approach to students with behavioural disorders. Can you give us some examples of that and perhaps some suggestions for teachers?
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a big topic.
It is a big topic, but I think it's such an important topic. And I experienced this both as a teacher and as a parent, you know, and I see it a lot amongst teachers. You know, I'm on a lot of teacher Facebook groups and everything. And I so often see, you know, I have this student with really difficult behaviors, and you know, the advice is, well, just, you know, cut them loose or whatever. And I'm just, oh, no, don't, you know, because to me, really, when student is exhibiting challenging behavior, it's really a sign that they're in distress. You know, it might cause us distress, but that's not really what it's all about. You know, they're in distress because if they're acting in difficult ways or, you know, however it's being manifested, it means that there's something going on with them that they need extra support. And so to me, that's where the empathy piece comes in and is always trying to look at, well, what's happening with the student that I can help them with right now to get over this? And, you know, for one thing, of course, to get them back in the learning zone so they can learn music because that's what they're there for. But also just from the perspective that if this child is exhibiting challenging behavior, they're probably seen as kind of the difficult kid wherever they go. You know, they're probably seen and treated that way at school. They might be seen and treated that way in other, you know, extracurricular activities. And the impact that you can have by showing that child empathy and, you know, connecting with them and showing them that you recognize that they're having a hard time, not that they're giving you a hard time, is huge for, you know, relationship building. And even just that step of having empathy, just saying, hey, what's going on right now, can diffuse things really, really quickly. But I think also, you know, looking at it as communication, what is this student telling me right now? Did I ask them to do something that is too challenging for them and they're frustrated? Do they need me to break it down for them more? Are they, you know, overwhelmed with sensory input? Maybe I need to adjust that. You know, looking at it from that perspective, okay, what is this telling me and how can I adjust? And that is a huge topic. I mean, there's like so much to do to unravel that. But what's key for me always is behavior is communication. And, you know, it's, we have to look at it that way and try to dig in and see how we can support this student.
We are in a unique position in our one-on-one situations with students, if we teach one-on-one rather than groups. And it's different to any situation really the child will be in during the day, particularly if they're at a school, of course. When the teacher, you know, it's so hard. I've been a classroom teacher and it's so difficult to have that opportunity to have empathy for a child who's exhibiting bad behavior because you start getting, I'm getting really angry here and it's really hard to do that. But we have that opportunity one-on-one. And we're really lucky to be able to do that. So I think that approach, just to look at behavior as the child is communicating something with you and try to work out what is being communicated here, not that they're just having a tantrum for whatever reason.
Yeah. And I don't want to minimize that. Yeah, it triggers us sometimes too. You know, I don't want to make it seem like it's not okay for you to be triggered. It's important for you to recognize that in yourself too. But I think that, you know, if you are looking at it from an empathetic point of view, it can kind of diffuse that in yourself sometimes too and make it, you know, easier on you as well. And it's such a privileged position to work one-on-one with these kids, right? Because often, you know, it is one-on-one. We get this time with them, but also often over years, right? Like they might stay in music lessons with you for a long time. So you have this opportunity to, you know, build something with them and it can be really special.
You mentioned sensory needs before, and that can have a massive impact. Before you even talk to the student or touch an instrument or anything at all, just being in particular rooms can be a challenge for certain students. What have you learned about that teachers could learn from you?
Yeah, I mean, I cannot overstate the importance of tuning into that with your students, especially if you're teaching students with autism, but really with a lot of different needs. I think that what's really important to understand is there's a view that students with autism in particular are hypersensitive to everything, right? Like they don't like loud sounds, they don't like bright lights, they, you know, can't stand fluorescent lights. And that's not necessarily the case. And if you're approaching it that way, then you could be in some trouble because what's more likely is that there's sort of a, you know, an individual profile that can be hyper or hyposensitive to anything. And that can include, you know, smell, like any of the senses. So they could be really sensitive to sound, but hyposensitive to touch or, you know, different things like that. And so what I see sometimes is teachers fall into the trap of removing a lot of the stimulation in the rooms. And it's very well intentioned. They're trying to keep things calm for their students. But then they have students bouncing around the rooms because they're seeking that stimulation, right? Like, we all have our optimal zone where we operate, right? Like, you might be someone that needs to go and sit in a cafe to work, and that's what you need. You need the like ambient noise, whereas somebody else needs like to be at home where it's quiet, and that's where they work the best. And everybody has that. But, you know, with students with autism or different sensory needs, sometimes that optimal zone is very narrow, you know, and we all try to get ourselves in there. But the thing is, for some students with exceptionalities, they can't function very well if they're outside of it. So if you're not giving them enough, they're going to seek it in sometimes disruptive ways. But also then if you give them too much, that's where meltdowns can happen. And, you know, so it really is looking at your student and looking at the clues that they're kind of showing you in their behavior. So if you see them, you know, going around and grabbing things really quickly and kind of making loud noises, like grabbing drums and banging them, they're just looking for stimulation. But the great thing about music is that's inherent in what we're doing. We just need to structure the lesson so that we're giving the stimulation so our student's not taking it in ways that we don't want them to. And we can structure a lesson that way. We can put in parts where there's more stimulation and then pull back to give them a break. It really is just carefully observing your students and seeing how are they reacting to different things that you're doing, and then sort of over time building out a structure where you're putting in these elements already so that they don't seek it. You have to just kind of be sensitive and make sure that you're meeting your student's sensory needs on either side of that spectrum.
Will they sometimes say, oh, bright, lights are too bright, or anything like that? Or do they tend to not verbalize it so much and it's just behavioral? You've got to take cues.
Yeah, I find it's more behavioral. I mean, and I work with a lot of students that are non or low verbal. So they're definitely not, you know, going to express it that way. But even students often that, you know, have the verbal capacity to express that are not always aware necessarily that those things are bothering them. You know, they feel irritable or, you know, but they don't necessarily maybe know why. So you can ask pointed questions. You can say, oh, is that bothering you? Or is that too loud for you? And kind of discover that way. But it could just be that you need to just observe and see and try different things and see how it works for them.
I imagine parents can be useful here too, because they will oftentimes already know. So perhaps even before the first lesson, you could ask that question, you know, what does your child have some sensory needs that I can work with before you arrive? Is that a good idea?
Absolutely. Well, and I mean, we always, our first lesson is basically, it's an intake meeting. So the parents come in and we ask all those questions and we try to get as much information about any behavioral triggers or any sort of supports that we can give that are motivating for the students, or, you know, also any language that's used that the student understands, you know, any information like that. And that communication with parents really needs to be ongoing.
Another one of your approaches is a strength-based approach for students with exceptionalities. Can you tell us about that as well?
I mean, I think it's important all the time, obviously, to look at our students' strengths and, you know, try to work with them. But the thing with students with exceptionalities is, you know, by definition, they're going to have some sort of impairments in some areas, right? So while all of us have our preferred modes of learning, right? You're a visual learner or you're an auditory learner or whatever. Most of us can kind of function in any way. So if we're, you know, sitting in a lecture and it's just being delivered by the lecturer speaking and that's not our preferred mode of learning, we can still follow along and get what we need. Mm-hmm. But a student that has impairments in auditory processing might not get anything out of that, right? So it's really important to know, what is this student's, you know, preferred learning or best way of learning or their strength? So if you, for example, have a student with autism that has absolute pitch, well, don't force them to learn by reading notes. They've got this incredible gift, you know. It's not to say that they can't learn to read music as well, but, you know, there might be impairments in those other areas that would make it just very, very frustrating for them. And it just makes the whole learning process easier for them and helps them to really, you know, reach their full potential in learning if we go through that pathway that's going to work best for them. Because if we just try to teach with the pathways we're most comfortable teaching with, it might not get in. And so it is really critical to understand, how is this student going to learn, and to then just go that way. And then the other piece of it is, you know, I use the strengths to teach the most challenging parts, like playing the instrument is usually, you know, challenging because they have to coordinate motor skills and everything with it. But then anything that is going to be more challenging, so let's say, you know, it's a student with dyslexia and note reading is going to be really challenging, then that's the thing I make the most fun of the lesson, like try to find the best note reading games we can find to kind of take the pressure off those parts that are likely to be more challenging. And then the things, you know, that are going to be sort of the meatier parts of the lesson, go with ways that are easy for that student to learn.
Mm. Building on the strengths of students, as you say, is something that we can all do. It doesn't mean that we don't do the other things, but we can always play to those strengths and the activities and the skills and experiences that the students really want to develop themselves. I always, you know, play to those strengths, because that's the way you get engagement too.
Exactly.
You talk about multimodality as well. Is that what you're talking about here with just the different approaches to the way that students learn best?
Yeah. And so there's two pieces to that. So one is, you know, identifying sort of the primary modality that works for this student. But really with students with exceptionalities, it's best to reinforce the learning in as many ways as you can. So don't necessarily rely on one way of teaching. And, you know, it's sometimes things really need to be worked on in different ways, or the same concept taught in different manners. And so with everything I'm teaching, I try to use, you know, visuals and kinesthetic learning and, you know, auditory learning, and kind of pull it all together in different ways. So, for example, if I'm teaching like keyboard geography, you know, there are maybe notebook activities we're going to do or something, but I also have these big foam keyboard pieces that I put on the ground. And then I have these like different colored gems that we put on, you know, I might say put a gem on every C or put a red one on every D or whatever. So they're getting up and moving around. That kind of meets their sensory need too, if they are a student that needs movement. But, you know, and then we take it to the piano and can, you know, work on it there. But it's just working on things in different ways to make sure there's reinforcement without just doing the same activity in the same way over and over again, because that's not fun for anybody.
Right. I want to mention here to COVID-19, obviously it's had an impact on all teachers, but I imagine a significant impact on teachers teaching students with exceptionalities, because you do use manipulatives and movement and things like that much more than perhaps traditional lessons. So how have you gone about approaching this, both yourself and with your team?
It has been challenging. I mean, yeah, it's been, you know, quite a number of months now that we've been at it. And while we've found, you know, more tools as we've gone along, there are some elements that there's just no substitute for. And, you know, to be honest, I would love to say we've been able to adapt for all of our students, but that's just not the case. You know, we do have probably about 30% of our students that really just working through a screen is not feasible for them. You know, just keeping that engagement in that manner doesn't really work. They need hand over hand support. They need, you know, somebody gesturing and modeling more than we can do. They need the manipulatives. So, you know, those students are just kind of on hiatus when we're not able to be in person. But for most, we have been able to find things like, I use Zoom a lot for my lessons. So even using the whiteboard and, you know, having parents on their end as well to kind of engage with them and do things that I would do, maybe like help them, you know, with movement or, you know, highlighting certain things in their books and all of those things that they might need support with. Having the parent there has been crucial for a lot of our students.
Mm. Yeah, and that's what I've seen a lot of teachers doing, just having the parent really has to be there. And you take a new approach. But I'm
While it's disappointing to hear the number that have been affected, I think you said 30% or so. It's no one's fault, and it's completely understandable. And I imagine the parents understand the situation and just look forward to being able to get back in person. In fact, are you guys still online, or are you moving back to in person up there? What's happening?
We've gone back and forth. So we were online all last spring, and then we've been back in person since the summer. And now just since Christmas, we've been online.
Back to online. That's frustrating, frustrating, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm keen to know, you've worked with a lot of teachers, and you're doing more and more of that now as you give professional development to other teachers around the world. What are some of the things that you notice teachers doing that are just things that you could easily fix early on?
Well, I think that there are really two kind of main overarching things. And one is taking certain skills for granted. I think not realizing, like, even things like, and I'm saying this like for myself too, there are certain things that I, you know, just were easy for me and natural that are not, like crossing the midline. For some kids, like moving an arm across their body is really difficult. And you can kind of see that. It for students with different, you know, movement issues. So like, and you can test it, like if you go to do like kind of a patty cake thing with your student and you hold your hand up and they don't go, they wait for you to keep going.
Okay.
So you can imagine there are a lot of instruments or different musical activities where that's impacted if the student has a hard time crossing their arm across their body, right? Mm. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, a lot of teachers are not aware of. There's lots of little things like that, or, you know, things that different movement things that if you can't see your hands, then you're not able to, you know, control them very well, or just, yeah, lots of things like that. And so the first thing I do with a lot of teachers is I get them to write a list of what are the skills you need to play your instrument. And they kind of write, you need to read notes and you need to do, like, no, it's hundreds of things. It's hundreds. You just aren't thinking of all of them because most of them you just did, you know, it was easy for you. And so really thinking, oh, all of those things, either some students may not be able to do those things and I need to find workarounds, or I need to teach each of those things explicitly. And so the second thing is the extent to which things need to be broken down. You know, really not taking for granted that you can kind of roll things together like you would with typical students, you know, that you might need to spend weeks working on something that would take 1 minute with a typical student. And that's fine. That's totally fine. It's just understanding that. And I think that for a lot of teachers that don't come into it knowing that that's what it's going to be like sometimes working with students with exceptionalities, they can feel frustrated, but they can also maybe feel like they're not doing a good job. You know, they're not the right teacher for this student. And I think having the expectation that, no, that's just the way it works sometimes, you know, it takes years to learn a skill that would take a month, and that's totally okay. Really can help a lot. Just understanding that you just, that's the way it's going to go.
Yeah. You've got to give yourself some grace and plenty of self-encouragement and things too, don't you? Because things, you can have disaster lessons where it doesn't matter what you do, you just, they don't work, and you have to be, I mean, that can happen in a normal lesson as well, depending on how your students, where they're at emotionally, but yeah, you've really got to be positive and easy on yourself, I think, because particularly when, if we do teach a relatively structured program to our other students, teaching a student with an exceptionality or a need can just blow that completely out of the water, and you've got to be open to that.
Yeah, well, and that's just it. Yeah, sometimes lessons go really off the rails, and that's, you know, it's okay. It happens to me still, you know, it will always happen. And it's just, you learn from it and see, okay, what could I do differently next time? And I, you know, it makes me sad sometimes when I see teachers get very discouraged by this, you know, when they really just want to help with the student. Well, if you want to help the student, you'll find a way. Just keep working on it.
You've created a great little one-page cheat sheet for us of your top five tips for teaching students with exceptionalities. I'd love to go through that with you just briefly because it summarizes much of what we've talked about today. Before we do that, is there anything else that you feel we've missed or you'd like to cover before we start wrapping things up?
No, I think we covered quite a lot, actually. I think the one thing that I would say that's, you know, really, really important for teachers is, you know, we were just kind of touching on it, but building your confidence is really key. There's a lot of research indicating that teachers' success will be dictated by how well they think they can do. And so, you know, if you go into it thinking I don't know what I'm doing, then as soon as something goes wrong, you're going to feel like, oh, I don't know, you know, how to teach this student. And I see that a lot in teachers. So, you know, building your own confidence, whether it's through doing training or reading books or just, you know, sticking with it or talking to the parents about whatever you need to do, is really key. Don't feel like because you don't have a lot of experience in this area, you can't do it. Everybody starts with a first student with special needs, right? Like you have to start somewhere, and that's fine. Just start with like an open heart and some creativity.
I remember interviewing Anastasia Butner-Moore, who's one of our members from Perth, probably last year, maybe the year before even. And she took on, she told the story of taking on a blind student for the first time. And she had never done anything like that before. And it was a remarkable story of resilience, I think, from both parties, both the child and the teacher. But it was incredible how she grew and what she learned from that experience. And she was able to bring this child right through to university level. It was quite extraordinary. So I think you're right. You have to be open and you have to be positive about it and realize that things aren't always going to work. But just like anything, you're going to learn as you go through things. And listening to podcasts like this will hopefully give you some tips along the way. So speaking of tips, let's run through these five tips just briefly as a bit of a summary before we finish. So tip number one was always taking that strength-based approach. Just remind us about that quickly.
Mm-hmm. So it's really, really key as a first step to try to get an idea of how your student best learns. And so you can do this by talking to the parents, for sure, or just, you know, observing them in the first lesson, just see what they do, try a few games with them, just do different things. But however you see they're sort of naturally engaging with music, structure your whole curriculum around that. And even if it's different than, you know, what you've tried before, if you're not used to teaching by ear and that seems to be the way the student's going to work, just try it. It will be a much, much easier and more successful process.
That links in beautifully with number two, which is simply be creative.
Yeah. And I know that seems that's very obvious. But the thing is, for most of us who have been taught, you know, traditionally and have a traditional approach, being creative might seem hard. It might seem kind of daunting. And because I think from my experience, the most challenging thing about teaching students with special needs has been the problem solving. You know, so often it's like, okay, the student doesn't seem to be quite mastering this. What do I need to do? How do I find a solution for this? And, you know, it is really trying to figure that out, but you do have to think really creatively and try different things. There's loads of stuff online, you know, it doesn't need to be activities for students with exceptionalities. Just look out there for different activities that, again, are strengths-based, right? So meet your students where they are with that, but don't be afraid to just try different things and see what works, because you never know what might work. And then you have something new in your toolkit, and for sure you'll be able to apply it different ways, but it's only in finding those new ways of teaching that you add to your toolkit over time.
You mentioned number three in passing, so I'm glad we're covering it again, because it's not the most obvious thing. Number three is do your best to make whatever is most challenging for your student the most fun part of the lesson. Now, I'll tend to, with a normal student, make the most challenging thing the first thing we do, or one of the earliest things we do, but not the most fun thing. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I think it's really important to remember that for a lot of students with different diagnoses, there can be a lot of challenges with emotional regulation, with executive function, like being able to focus and, you know, persevere through things and not get overwhelmed with frustration. And, you know, a lot of teachers find that difficult, but that's just as much a valid part of their disorder as anything else, right? And so we have to work with that. Don't just, you know, expect them to push through it. If they have challenges with that, they're legitimate challenges. And so if they have a harder time managing frustration or persevering through things, you're just doing both of you a service if you make it as fun as you can to help them get it. I mean, really, our objective as teachers is for them to learn it, right? And they're going to be more likely to learn it if you can make it engaging and fun. But the other piece of that is they're more likely to stick with learning longer, right? If you can make it engaging and fun. And so if you start to see that your student is having a hard time persevering or they're having a hard time managing their frustration, don't just push through it. With typical students, you might do that and it might kind of be a lesson for them in learning to push through. It might not be that successful with students with exceptionalities. Make it fun and engaging for them.
That's a great tip. Number four, we've talked about already, which is being aware of the sensory environment and how that may impact your student. And I think we've talked about that a fair bit today. And number five was approaching any challenging behavior with empathy. And that was just a reminder that if your student is struggling with something, try and find out what it is that's causing that. Did you want to say anything else on that one?
Well, I think that, you know, there are really two pieces to that. You know, the one is the relationship and rapport building, you know, having the opportunity to be a positive force for your student and maybe, you know, help them to figure these things out themselves as well. But the other piece is just the music learning piece. You know, behavioral issues can derail learning, you know, school, music lessons, whatever. If a student has, you know, pretty severe behaviors, they can really make it impossible to learn. And so tuning into why these behaviors are coming up, and again, it comes back to problem solving. You can't solve the problem if you don't know what it is. So if a student is going and grabbing a drum off the shelf and it's not time to do that, the problem is not that the student is grabbing the drum. The problem is that the student's not getting enough stimulation and they're seeking out stimulation. If all you're trying to solve is the student's running and grabbing the drum, you're not solving the problem. You have to figure out what the problem is if you're going to solve it.
Mm. Easier said than done.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I think is wonderful about this is that you are, you have created a teacher institute and you are really sharing more and more of these amazing things that you've learned through your research and also your own teaching. So tell us about the institute and some of the professional development that teachers can access.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really excited to finally be launching this because it's something that I've wanted to do for years. It's really multi-level opportunities for teachers to engage with professional development. So we have just 1 hour free webinars on a variety of topics that teachers can tune into. It's all online, so it's available for anyone. We'll have mini courses in different courses and different topics that are about 3 hours long. And I'm, you know, always very open to feedback from teachers on what they're looking for topics. And then starting in the fall, we're going to have intensive courses that will, you know, result in a certificate in special music education. So these will be 8-week courses that will be similar in scope to kind of a university course. And there will be 3 levels to them. But really, you know, my goal is always to improve access to music education for people with exceptionalities. And, you know, we can only teach so many of them at Lotus Center in the city where we're at. So, you know, for me, being able to get these tools out and the skills to teachers is, you know, going to have the most impact. And so I'm really, really excited to be getting this off the ground.
Very much following my own mantra of helping teachers can have more of an impact. So thank you very much for sharing what you've shared today. It's been wonderful to connect with you and to hear some of those tips. So a reminder that you can download Dr. Parks's 5 tips cheat sheet. You can stick it next to your piano or have it in your diary for when you're next starting a new student, just to remind you of some of those things to think about. And where can teachers go to find out more about your institute and also your studio?
Mm-hmm. So our Lotus Center website is lotuscenter.net, center's T-R-E, and the institute website is almost the same, it's just institute.lotuscenter.net, and the contact information is there if they would want to email me as well.
Fantastic. And we'd love to hear if you do have questions that you would like Dr. Parks and her team to answer in their training, then if you're watching this on a podcast or something, jump on our website, head to the show notes, leave a comment there, or you can find us on social media. and leave a comment in Facebook or Instagram, wherever you're listening and choosing to connect with us. Dr. Parks, thank you so much for your time today. It's been magical. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed today's episode and you want to grab Dr. Parks's cheat sheet, then make sure you head over to topmusic.co/episode230, where you can find all our show notes, a full transcript, and the download link for her one-page cheat sheet. I hope today's episode was useful for you. Next week, teacher and new podcaster Christina Whitlock joins us from Illinois. I really look forward to sharing that episode with you then. I'm Tim Topham, and you've been listening to the Topcast from topmusic.co. I will see you next time. For more information about this episode and to find out how to enhance your own teaching, visit topmusic.co. You'll find everything you need for your studio, from lesson plans to cheat sheets, quick win teaching ideas, and guides on how to build your teaching business. Plus, you'll be connected to a global community of the world's top music teachers. And when you're ready, join hundreds of other teachers around the world by becoming a Top Music Pro member and get access to all our bonus content and flagship courses. And don't forget to follow topmusic.co on social media and subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. That's all for today. We'll see you in the studio.